Keith Leonard's poems have appeared in Best New Poets, Copernickel, and Gulf Coast, and have been nominated for Pushcart Prizes. Ramshackle Ode is his first book. Keith, welcome to Words on a Wire.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. Congratulations on this fantastic new book of poems, Ramshackle Ode, your very first book. You do have a chapbook that came out a couple of years ago, but this is your very first full-length book, and it's with Mariner Books. Certainly, you know, one of the best publishers and one of the hardest publishers to get as a poet. They don't do poetry. How did that happen?
You know, it's kind of one of those. I was dreamy. I just was at a reading. I gave a reading, you know, a short one, just like 5 minutes,
uh-huh.
at a conference in Vermont. And one of the editors was there, and she approached me after the reading and said, "Hey, send me a few poems." And I didn't think anything of it at all. But you know, I just shot off a few to her, and then she asked me to send the book, and I sent it. Time went by, and then suddenly I got an email in the middle of January when my spouse was very pregnant, and it said yes, and she jumped out of her chair.
Wow.
Pregnant and all, yeah. And
did the baby John the Baptist-like kick in the mother's tummy?
Yeah, maybe.
Because that is a fantastic story, because that doesn't happen very often. I mean, you know, we like to fantasize about things like that. And it's not that these poems don't deserve it. These poems are amazing. Before we get into the book, maybe we can have a little bit of background about you, where you're from, where you grew
sure.
up.
Yeah. So I grew up on Martha's Vineyard off the coast of Massachusetts. And, you know, my dad's a postmaster there. His dad was a postmaster there. My mom's a school nurse there, and wow. So we're just like part of that little island community that's year-round. And then in the summer, something like 200 and I think it's 20,000 people show up.
Wow.
And the island gets, it gets wild and fun. But yeah, so it was a really interesting place to grow up in. You know, it's very isolated, surrounded by water, which was pretty wonderful. But also, you know, there's some interesting parts about that where it's really, there's a lot of solitude.
Yeah.
Perhaps too much solitude sometimes. But it is interesting, yeah.
Well, you know, that just seems like a wonderful background for mm-hmm. a writer. I mean, Martha's Vineyards for us, I'm from California, and Martha's Vineyard for people who have never been there is just kind of this place of the imagination where rich East
yeah.
Coast people go for vacation. And, you know, it evokes, you know, the literary history like John Updike and, you know, figures like that. And so I imagine growing up there, having that solitude, and then suddenly there's 200,000 people there, you know, it's just so perfect for a poet to think about things, to think about, you know, changes and to think about people and images.
Yeah. I mean, you really pay attention to the seasons when you're there, too, because they affect everything. You know, if you have to take a ferry across the water to get to the mainland, right, it matters what the weather is doing.
Right. And I imagine what's happening with a lot of touristy places is they are becoming overtaken with Epcot culture. It's like
yeah.
you know, there used to be, you know, locals. There used to be a postmaster.
Yeah.
There used to be a school nurse who lived, you know, in decent houses. But I imagine
right.
it'd be really difficult to buy a house right now in Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, you know, that's so true. It's actually, I was talking to one of my high school friends about this just the other day. Well, we're the first generation of local people to not be able to buy a house.
Wow.
Back in our other place that we grew up with. Like, it's effectively impossible. Even the, you know, the people who teach high school there have to live in like an affordable housing program because
wow.
it's just so impossible. So yeah, so it's a really interesting community that is extremely tight knit, but also dwindling for
yeah.
sure.
You know, that makes me wonder, in a sense, that's kind of displacement. I mean, here you have
mm-hmm.
your native land, and probably if you wanted to go back and you wanted
yeah.
to bring your family there, it would be very difficult if you don't have, you know, if you're not making $1 million off of your books.
Yeah, you're speaking my mother's worries. that's what's happening.
So I'm wondering if that, in any way, that kind of the land that belongs to you, your native
mm-hmm.
land being so
mm-hmm.
alienated from you financially, if that is
mm-hmm.
affecting the way you write landscape in your poetry. And I notice there's not
yeah.
a lot of landscape in your poetry.
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, if there is poems in the book that deal with that landscape of my home, they're usually pretty sad, actually.
Right.
Kidding. But, yeah, no, I found a new landscape, a new home in Indiana. It was some place that I never thought that I'd live. I just never really considered it. But I went out there for graduate school and was introduced to this project called the Bloomington Community Orchard, which I don't even know how to describe it. I guess the best way to describe it is, like, if you could picture Willy Wonka's factory and everything was extremely healthy. It's this public park where it's all volunteer run. There's just 100+ fruit trees where anyone can go in and just eat fruit. And so I've worked on that for a long time, and it's become sort of a new home in many ways.
That makes a lot of sense, because as I read your book, like I said, there's not a lot of specific landscape. There is one poem called A Brief History that kind of evokes Martha's Vineyard or evokes that kind of landscape. But most of the landscape that does appear in your poem really is about sticking your hands in the earth and gardening.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if this is saying too much about it, but it seems to be an inspiring aspect.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually, okay, so one of my mentors is Ross Gay, who I actually worked on that project with. You know, he's an amazing teacher in that most of his lessons come well outside of the classroom. And so, you know, he got me into this orchard, and, you know, it changes a lot of perspective for poetry in some really strange ways, to watch things grow and participate in that. It's a little bit more hopeful.
You know, I'm reading both your book and Ross Gay's latest book at the same time, because I'm having him on the show later on. And I started to see similarities, especially in the way you write about joy and how joy is more complex than just happiness, that joy you know, comes from things that carry tension as well. And then I looked at the back of your book, and I noticed that you said, "Thank you, Ross Gay, for the figs." And I couldn't help but think of that first poem in his new collection about the fig tree. And I thought, was Keith Leonard one of those people around the fig tree gathering figs?
Yeah. We helped plant this amazing little fig tree, which, you know, they shouldn't be growing in Indiana, but they somehow do.
Right.
And we built a limestone patio around it, and it's turned into this pretty amazing tree that, yeah, like, people go underneath and reach up and eat figs. Very dreamy.
So when did you know you were going to be a poet? At what point in your life?
Oh, well, you know, my grandfather was I guess I'd describe him as like a holiday poet. Uh-huh. He'd write these little rhyming poems that would essentially just eviscerate my family, just make fun of them so bad. But because they were in rhyme, they loved them. And so poetry, the way that I was exposed to it, was something that was communal and joyful. And so I think I always had a really strong connection with it, or at least feeling that poetry could be something that's meant to be shared. And then I went to undergrad, and I had this professor who, like, you know, like the story goes, you meet someone that really inspires you. Right, her name was Leah Nielsen. She was wonderful. And she would give me five literary magazines a week and say, read through all these and then report back to me what's, like, the difference between all of them. So I got used to reading a lot of contemporary poetry, which has been wonderful.
Like who were your initial poetic influences? People you read and said, I got it. Oh, man, that's wonderful. That's fantastic.
Yeah, so originally it was Wordsworth. I just remember...
Really?
And I really still love some of his poems, but I love them so much that I ended up doing a study abroad in England just to walk around the Lake District where he was writing his poems.
Wow.
And took some kind of amazing hikes there. Yeah, and I just love how, like, the romantic poets in general dive into the imagination and let the poem breathe and kind of show us the shape of imagination in some ways. But now, you know, lately I've been really into Linda Hull, who I think is really underread, but her language is so just ecstatic and amazing.
When I first started as a writer, or before I started as a writer, I'm a fiction writer, one of my early influences was Joseph Heller, who wrote Catch-22.
Oh, yeah.
And other works. I used to read everything I could by him. I thought he was brilliant. And now, as I go back to Joseph Heller, I say, well, it's not that good.
Right. No, I don't know the same way about words.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you. Were there some poets that you really loved, and now you look back and go, oh, I shouldn't let them influence
yeah.
me?
Yeah. No, there's a lot of problems with Wordsworth and the way he simplifies people and especially who he considers the poor. He generally creates a caricature out of that. Yeah, I bet there's some problems I have with Wordsworth now, for sure.
Well, let's talk about Ramshackle Ode, your first book. Mm-hmm. Ramshackle means a state of severe disrepair. Why mm-hmm. is it called Ramshackle Ode?
Yeah, so I feel like that is sort of at least my joy, and maybe some others' joy, that it's always inexact and never pure. Mm-hmm. It takes understanding of, you know, what is in disrepair to then also find out what you love in some ways.
Right,
so, like,
absolutely.
Yeah, and I think odes are a really interesting mode of poetry in that often they move through something difficult to get to something joyful, especially in the contemporary odes. And I think that seems to be sort of like a little life philosophy, is like dealing with the negativity to get towards something you can appreciate.
There is a lot of joy in this book, and it gets a complex joy, but you
yeah.
only use the word joy once.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
That
and
great.
a lot of descriptions of your book, they evoke the word joy. And I'm wondering, and I guess you've already answered it by your reaction, is if were there times when you had to avoid using it and looking for a different way to say it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think, well, whenever I was approaching writing these poems, I'd sit down and say, like, I'd like to, the goal of the poem is try to reach some type of joy
right.
through a difficult situation or event, and then sometimes that wouldn't happen at all, but maybe I just avoided the word joy because that was the end goal, so, like, to mention it earlier would be getting ahead.
One of the things I really love about this book, and one of the reasons why I think this book is going to do very well, and why you're going to obviously be a very important American poet, is the syntax. I love to follow your sentences, and I love how they just kind of lead me and give me, there's a suspense, there's this tension, because I don't know where it's going to end, where it's going to bring me, where it's going to drop me off, whether it's going to be an image or a theme or, you know, some sort of conclusion. And I'll give you an example. On page 77, you have this poem called In the Headwinds of a Fable. And it's just fantastic to ride this sentence all the way to the end. And it's like you have, in fact, it even says here, it says, imagine if this sentence stretches long enough, it might break into a road with little rumble strips and ditch grass and guardrails for all of us to hop in my car, to drive along, and then it just keeps going and takes us all the way to the end of the poem. And I'm wondering, when you're writing and you're following the sentence, you're following the syntax, because I'm going to assume that a lot of your poems start with just the rhythm, the syntax. Are you ever surprised or always surprised or mainly surprised where it leads you?
Yeah, yeah. Well, first off, thanks for all saying all that. That was very nice. But yeah, that's the intention. I think of syntax, I think of Gerald Stern mm-hmm. in his poems, where it seems like every time the poem could end, he just puts in the word and or puts in a comma. Or
yeah, yeah.
And it becomes this gathering, and you never know where the poem's going to go. And I'm trying to do something similar. The thing that I love so much about writing, and especially poems, is that, like, the test, I think, of a good poem is if you arrive somewhere you had no idea you were going.
Yeah.
Because then, I mean, what's that Robert Frost quote? Like, the no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader.
Right, right.
The idea that you should arrive somewhere that you had no idea you're going. And syntax is a great way of doing that, just to keep pushing yourself and also maybe not limiting or suspending the rules of grammar
right,
a little bit.
Right, right.
to get there. Yeah.
One of my favorite quotes when it comes to what we're talking about in terms of being surprised by our own work comes from Borges. And, and he says that if a writer achieves what he sets out to achieve, it's probably not worth much.
Right. Do you find the same thing in fiction when you're writing?
Oh, absolutely. And it reminds me also of an interview I read with Don DeLillo in the Paris Review, and he says that he's more than willing to allow the rhythm of the sentence to direct the meaning.
Yeah.
You know, and I sense that in your work, because we can start with a strawberry, for example, your wonderful poem, Strawberries for Dinner. And it starts off, you know, focused on the strawberry and says, good for the strawberry for wearing all its seed on its skin. Too few things say, here's all of me like that, not the apple. And, you know, it goes on, but it starts with the strawberry and ends with Icarus.
Yeah.
You know, and that to me is a completely non-forced metaphor. It's just metaphorical possibilities that come out of following the sentence. And it's different to say, I think, a lot of poets, if you ask them, you know, how do you enter into a poem? Most of them will say image. I had Linda Gregerson on the show a while back. I don't know if you know her work or not, but beautiful syntax. And she was one of the very first who says, I follow the syntax. That's how I get into a poem. And it seems to me that that's kind of what you do. And I want to know how you started with a strawberry and ended with Icarus.
Well, I'll say this. My wife is a poet as well. And one of the things that we've always talk about this, there's so many Icarus poems.
Yeah.
There's so many Icarus poems. And I was always like, I'm never going to write an Icarus poem ever. And, but with that particular poem, that's where the sentence led to. And so I was like, God, well, damn, there it is. I guess that's a poem now. But one of the things that I do to keep the syntax moving is to have, and this feels a little bit like cheating, but I have a little bank of words to the side of whatever I'm writing on. And if ever I find maybe the thought process or the syntax starting to come to a close and nothing interesting has happened in the poem yet, I'll insert one of those words and see how that changes the thought process. Because inevitably that'll have me associate whatever came before it with whatever that word, however that word pushes it on.
Oh, that's a brilliant idea. So it's almost as if, you know, to convert it into metaphor, it's like you're stirring a pot, you know, and you know, you don't know what it's going to taste like. And then when it starts to maybe, you're not quite sure, you add an ingredient that you have on the side, just kind of waiting and see how that, that fits into
really
the whole stew.
That's great.
I'm wondering if as you're writing and as you're following syntax, you know, or language, rhythm, music, as you're following that, and I do know that you pay a lot of attention to the music because you have lines like, and it went on boot-thudded and shoal-scraped, and it went on boot-thudded and shoal-scraped. You know, you repeat it. And so clearly the music is picking up. And I think that, do you find that when you're writing and you're just following the language and you're not really sure where it's going, that suddenly the voices of other poets assert themselves into your language?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I always feel like I'm imitating people that are very, even if I'm not conscious of it. One thing that there was a period where I was working after graduate school at a Trader Joe's.
Nice.
I mean, I actually really enjoyed the job a lot because they stuck me in the milk freezer, the milk cooler in the back. So there was no one, you know, watching me all day, but I would I'd write out a poem by someone I really loved, Gerald Stern, Terrence Hayes, Marie Howe, and I'd have that in my pocket and I'd pull it out and put it on the shelf that I was stocking milk on. And I'd memorize that poem that day, and then by the end of the night, when I was done, I'd get home and I'd have that poem and that rhythm inside, kind of like already memorized. And so when I went down to write, I think inevitably, you know, that rhythm, that syntax, sometimes even the language comes through in some of the poems that are in that book.
Yeah,
for sure.
And you know, one of the ways I like to express that phenomenon, because it happens, you know, I think anybody who follows language, who follows rhythm into a story or into a poem, is in a sense, it allows the antepasados, those who came before us. It yeah. allows them to appear into our work, and even when we're not aware of it. And because it allows that, it probably allows imagery that we may not have planned to be into the work, simply because they're images that they stopped at. They're archetypes where they stopped and looked around. And maybe that's how, this is maybe sounding a little crazy now, Icarus appeared in your poem. The poets demanded it, that you followed language and the poets took you there.
That's fantastic. That is wonderful. I love that. That's great. Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. I totally agree with that.
How many times do you write a poem? I mean, tell me about your revision process.
Yeah, so it all, I think, depends on the poem. So there's some poems in the book that are more meditative. They're more image-based as opposed to syntax-based, and those ones take a lot of revision because it's sort of like chiseling away at each individual image.
Uh-huh.
But the syntactical poems, the ones that move kind of quickly down the page, those are generally written, they're like written in one sitting and then tweaked in maybe a couple more sittings, but they generally come out whole because the whole intention of them is to arrive somewhere. So it's really about like the experience of thinking through that problem to maybe a solution.
Do you write longhand or do you write
I'm the worst. I write on a computer. I wish I was able to write longhand, but I'm a terrible speller. I am a horrible speller. I don't know what's up with that.
When we had Mark Strand on the show, I asked him about his process, and he says he always writes longhand with no line breaks at all. And,
really?
And then he goes back, and when he types it or word processes it, that's when he adds the line breaks. And the reason why he said is because when he types it the first time and puts line breaks, it looks physically like it's a done poem.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and he doesn't want that to influence where the line break should actually go in the revision. And so,
that's great. You know, I do that with fonts. I start with a really ugly font when I'm writing out the poem, and then when it's in the final draft, I change it to, I think I use Garamond because it looks more finished to me for some reason.
That's interesting. I'm talking to Keith Leonard, poet. His first book is Ramshackle Ode. It's out by Mariner Books. And we were talking about following language into a poem, because a poem in many ways is a landscape, even if it's not a very concrete physical place. It does lead to imageries out in the ether, a word that you might use. There's these wonderful images that it'll lead us to. And I'm wondering if, as you're following the language, if you ever fight against it, you don't want it to go where it seems to want to go.
Yeah, absolutely. There's one poem in the book especially where it's called Ode to Dreaming the Dead, and it was, I was trying to, I was having dreams about people that I know who have passed away, and I'd wake up at night and make like some warm milk and try to fall back to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to write a poem that took that like very sad moment and made it into something joyful somehow, but the language wouldn't allow it to do that.
So in
that poem, about like halfway through, the speaker says, I'm sorry, this poem isn't turning, it's not going to be joyful this time, and that's all right. Because the language wouldn't, I just couldn't find the language to make it.
Yeah,
happy.
the exact quote, and this is the only time you mentioned the word joy in the book.
Oh.
And if you're waiting for the moment this poem pivots into joy, I'm sorry, it's not coming this time.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's the one moment, too. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. Let's talk about the poem Lord. It's Lord, comma. So it's almost as if it's a prayer. And I'm going to go ahead and read it because it's very short. Lord, I play a game some nights, quarter an apple, and toss each piece to a corner of the yard, turn off the lights, and wait for what might arrive. This is a fantastic poem. How did this one come about?
Well, it's something that I used to do. We live in a place where, because I grew up on that island, there's no real predators for deer around. The deer population explodes, so you could throw out an apple into your backyard, turn off the lights, and within minutes turn the lights back on, and a deer will be there.
Wow.
eating the apple.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, it's wonderful. But and I was thinking about that as a metaphor for spirituality in many ways. Like how sometimes it arrives suddenly. Sometimes it feels like fishing out, and maybe something, there's nothing there. You're just sort of waiting. I'm personally not like a deeply, deeply spiritual person, even though I'm really interested in the rituals of spirituality. So like lately I've been attending just Quaker meeting just to see what that was like. Yeah. And I love like a communal silence. I'm finding that really interesting. And then there's also this other church I just go to because I think it's interesting to be around people who are spiritual, even though I may not be myself. Yeah.
Well, you know, I was listening to this interview with Charles Wright the other day, and he was saying that he is not even slightly spiritual and won't even use the word spiritual because he feels like he feels like it's facetious for to say it, or he feels it's superficial. But the fact is, you know, when you focus on the ordinary like you do, and Ross Gay as well, and you have this one image where buttoning up your shirt is satisfying, you know, which also evokes that Ross Gay poem about to buttoning up your shirt. And it's those moments where to evoke the power of now, kind of the Buddhist Zen type of thing. It's those moments where your spirituality really comes out.
Right, I mean, I find the same... often the same like feeling of peace can come from gardening than it can from sitting in a Quaker meeting. Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to ask you how enjambment is related to your syntax, and I'm looking at a poem right now, just as an example, "Ode to the Unsayable," and you have these lines, and I'm going to go ahead and read them so the listeners can hear the line breaks. If you were a boy in America, maybe they beat this world into the dungeon of you too.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how you decide on where a line ends. What's more important? Is it the rhythm? Is it maybe the sentido of a particular line?
Rhythm is certainly really important. I think too, it's the relationship that's being set up in the poem. So like that poem, "Ode to the Unsayable," like, it's very staccato because it's about like not being able to say the word love, which is sort of, which as an experience, you know, every time wanting to say it and it being shut down is like little jabs, right? Whereas like a poem maybe that's observing like landscape, a large landscape, having a long line and it's more meditative in that way, feels more true to the experience for me. Or even like a couplet, I like to employ couplets when there's two speakers or at least two characters in the poem, as if they're having a relationship. So I don't know if that's how you're supposed to do it. I don't know if there is a way that you're supposed to do it, but I often think about the form a poem takes as mirroring the subject.
Well, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are going to learn a lot from listening to you talk about your process. It's fascinating. And one other question I have to ask this. Did you do 1.5 spaces instead of single spaces on the poems?
No. They're single spaced. They extended out some of the poems, and I think I really enjoy it because the poems are can be so thick looking in some ways because they're all one stanza. So I think I was really happy with what they did. I think it enhances. Maybe being able to.
And I've read three books of poems in the last couple of weeks. You, Ross Gay, and Thomas Lux.
And
all of them have that. It seems like it's a 1.5 as opposed to one.
That's
and
interesting.
Even though I know it is only one, it does seem like it's 1.5, and it really does make the poems make you linger a little bit long on each line, and I really like that. It's a wonderful book. It's called Ramshackle Ode by Keith Leonard. Keith, would you be willing to read one of your poems?
Yeah, I would love to. I'd actually love to read, you said, In the Headlands of the Fable.
Oh, perfect.
I've never read that one.
Okay.
So I will read it. In the Headlands of a Fable. My friends and I live with small patches of hurt, and I sit on my couch in the early morning and write a word, then another, and imagine if this sentence stretches long enough, it might break into a road with little rumble strips and ditch grass and guardrails for all of us to hop in my car to drive along. Our pockets of worry torn from our shirts and flung to the faded dotted lines that disappear a little more every day because they must, like this road must turn to gravel, like this gravel must turn to dirt, until it narrows into a hairline trail, and we park and bury the keys and follow one another down the thinning walk, one foot in front of the other until we stop. For no other reason but to stop like pack mules twittering shoulders in the May moon cold, and Julie casually picks at a cigarette burn on her wrist, and Sam watches the stars charismatically collapse, and he isn't thinking of the neon shine from his brother's moped skittering away on the city street, and nobody's looking down at their feet. We're watching Julie, who lifts the scab like a secret to block out the moon, all of the moon. And we're watching still as she takes away the pinch in her fingers, as the scab stays there, suspended in the air, perfectly fastened to the light. And we all take turns looking through this paper-thin wafer like an unsightly telescope, the stained glass window of skin so vital and durable and true.
That was Keith Leonard reading his poem In the Headwinds of a Fable from his new book, Ramshackle Ode. Keith, I think this book is going to take off, and congratulations. Oh, wow. It's a beautiful book. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.